Recently, many states have moved up the dates of their presidential primaries. Joining me now to look into the implications of those changes and the role the primaries play in nominating a candidate is Linda L. Fowler. She's a professor of government and the Frank J. Reagan 09 chair in policy studies at Dartmouth College. I'm very pleased to welcome her to this month's Backstory. Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. Dartmouth is in New Hampshire, the state which has long had the first primary. When did that tradition begin?
Well, our primary goes back to the 50s, but it didn't become important until 1968 when Gene McCarthy launched an insurgent candidacy over the Vietnam War. And Lyndon Johnson, who was president then, actually won the primary, but it was a fairly unconvincing win. And it prompted him to basically withdraw from the race and leaving the wide open field that subsequently emerged. So it went on for a while, but didn't really become important. And beginning with that McCarthy race, it became a place where candidates sort of earned their spurs, sometimes creating momentum effects to take them into the other races and, or in Bill Clinton's case, sort of getting another chance. So the state had a long history of basically picking, having the judgment of picking the people who ended up later on becoming the nominees.
Although for a while, a factor in the old days was William Loeb, the publisher of the Union Leader, who had very strong political views and his own. And since he died, has that whole nastiness been eliminated?
Yes, the Union Leader isn't a factor in the state that it used to be. The state is politically more liberal than it was in his day. The major media outlet now really is WMUR, the ABC affiliate, which runs out of Manchester. But it's also the case that a lot of people in New Hampshire moved here from Massachusetts. They read the Boston Globe, they listen to Boston television and radio, and so the state is has many more points of view now than it did in Loeb's heyday.
Doesn't the New Hampshire state constitution have a clause that the presidential primary must be the first?
I'm not sure it's in the constitution. It is a statute that actually requires the Secretary of State to set the primary at least a week ahead of any other primary.
And Nevada has challenged that by moving its primary up to January 19th.
Well, Nevada is a caucus, and that's how they sort of finessed it. But basically, it's been a game of chicken, in a sense, because New Hampshire had this statute in place ahead of time. It basically could say, okay, go ahead and put your primary where you want, and we'll automatically move ours. But basically, we're now getting so close to New Year's Day that I think the power of that counter move that New Hampshire has is really coming to an end, because the absurdity of having primaries on Christmas is starting to come up in the cartoons in the state's newspapers, and so the state has now gotten pretty about as early as it can afford to get without becoming irrelevant.
Well, let's talk about caucuses. The most important caucuses until Nevada moved up too so early were the Iowa caucuses, which happened a few weeks before the New Hampshire primary. Now, how much impact do the caucuses have, and how different are they from a primary? Do they serve the same function as a primary?
Okay, the caucuses, of course, as your listeners probably know, are groups of citizens who get together in living rooms and schools. And the whole key to winning the Iowa caucuses and presumably the Nevada caucus will be activists getting a relatively small number of people to go and sit in these places and really commit to a 2 or 3 hour discussion about the candidates. The New Hampshire primary is a little different, and I think the reason why it's been so important is it's the first election where voters actually go into a booth and pick a candidate. So there isn't the kind of face-to-face deliberation, and it also doesn't require the same time commitment. And so the turnout in the New Hampshire primary, even though we're a tiny state, involves many more thousands of voters than is the case in Iowa, which is a larger state. And the New Hampshire primary is unusual also in that since 1996, independents are able to participate in either party's primary. They get to choose when they walk in the door what party they want to become a member of for the purposes of that day's primary. And then they can go back to being independent. So in many ways, unlike many primaries, it's not just the strong partisans who weigh in on the nominees, but also this group of unaffiliated voters. And so that makes the New Hampshire primary probably more representative of the candidate's real appeal.
Although in both cases, Iowa and New Hampshire, we're talking about small states. And so
Absolutely. The
focus becomes very different than it would be
yeah.
in California or New York.
And they're homogeneous states as well.
So is that a reason that the candidates wind up spending so much time talking about retail politics?
Yeah. In Iowa, it's all about ethanol and corn. In New Hampshire, it used to be taxes because New Hampshire voters required people to take what was called take the pledge, which was that you wouldn't raise taxes. And that isn't so important anymore. But basically, the criticism of New Hampshire's front status has always been it's not just a small state, it's a very homogeneous state. And it's also a very affluent state. And particularly among Democrats, the fact that there are no minorities or almost none in the state has been seen as being a liability. With respect to the Republican primary, the fact that there's a very small religious conservative evangelical cadre here in the state is also, you know, viewed by Republicans as being a problem. And that the Christian evangelicals are a very important part of the Republican base, and they're just not very influential in New Hampshire politics. So both parties have had people in them saying, well, the state isn't representative of either party. My view is that what's important about New Hampshire is that it allows the independents, the centrists, to vote. And in many ways, the chronic problem with primary elections in the United States is that in most places, turnout is very, very low. It's 12-15% of the electorate. In New Hampshire, it's well over 50% when you've got both parties running primaries. And because of the independents, you can't have the primary being captured by either left-wing extremists or right-wing extremists. And that's what you get in many primaries in many states, because only the ideological activists show up to vote.
Now, you mentioned ethanol as being the big issue in Iowa. California is moving its primaries up to February 5th. And one of its big issues is fuel standards. So we're going to have this odd thing where we'll have candidates in potentially sticky situations at the beginning. In fact, I suspect because all these primaries are being grouped so close together, people are going to be speaking out of more than just both sides of their mouths. They're going to have to be appealing so differently to different states all at once.
Well, I think we really effectively have a national primary now, and that the candidates' messages increasingly have to be tailored to a national electorate because the primary schedule is so compressed now, they're not going to be able to say one thing to Iowa voters and something else to New Hampshire voters. They're going to have to basically have a single message. And some people think that's a good thing.
My guest is Linda L. Fowler, who is a professor of government and the Frank J. Reagan 09 chair, that's 1909, chair in policy studies in Dartmouth College. I didn't want to suggest that the chair was endowed 2 years into the future, Linda. So
I've had it since 1909.
We're talking about the primaries in our backstory segment today. Well, primaries have been around for a while, haven't they? But they haven't been as important until fairly recently. When did the primary system begin?
Well, as I say, periodically one state's or another state's primary would be important. In 1960, the West Virginia primary was very important for John Kennedy. in proving that he could win a Protestant state and that his Catholicism wouldn't be a problem nationally. And I've already talked about the 1968 primary ending LBJ's drive for re-election. It was really after 1972 when something called the McGovern Commission in the Democratic Party basically changed the Democratic Party rules, and the Republicans pretty much went along with this, although I'm not sure why, to basically open up the nomination system.
Because in those days, the five men in a room, actually the smoke-filled room,
right,
was a reality in some cases. And some people look back to that time, as undemocratic as it is, with nostalgia, because they said often better candidates were picked, people who weren't always, and dark horse candidates could wind up becoming still having a chance, whereas now the convention winds up being pretty much just a coronation rather than a nomination experience.
Excuse me, I have a cold. I don't mean to cough in your listeners' ears. Well, there's never been any evidence that the convention system produced inferior candidates in terms of electability. It's also not clear that the primaries have produced inferior candidates either. I think what most people object to, at least political scientists do, about the primary system are two things. One, as I mentioned earlier, is the fact that because the participation rate is so low, that the ideological extremes, the activists, really end up being able to hijack the process. And you see the candidates right now sort of grappling with that problem. On the Democratic side, the candidates are being pulled by the anti-war activists to be very aggressive in opposing the prosecution of the war in Iraq the way the Bush administration is doing it. On the other hand, they know full well that if they get too far toward the anti-war side, that they're going to have difficulty in the general election campaign. The same is true in the Republican side, where the Christian right is trying to, pull Republicans to the right. And you've seen John McCain, Mitt Romney, Rudolph Giuliani really grappling with these pressures, again, knowing full well that if they move too close to the Christian right position, that they will have trouble getting back to the center for the general election. So that's the first problem, is that the candidates end up in this tug-of-war that pulls them too far to the extremes to get the nomination, and then they end up having to sort of reposition themselves for the general election, which can sometimes be problematic. But the other problem is that the early primaries really create momentum effects. And in many ways, in many states, because the candidates are spending all their time campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, after those early contests, the candidates have to fan out, and the primary voters in, say, North Carolina or New York or California in the past would not have seen very much of these candidates. And mostly what they know is that the press tells them, well, John Kerry did better than expected in Iowa, and Howard Dean is out. And so suddenly John Kerry comes in and does well in New Hampshire, and then he just gets this momentum. And people end up voting for John Kerry because he looks inevitable. And that happened, of course, with George Bush in 2000 in his contest with John McCain. And so the race ends up being sort of over before the candidates have really been very thoroughly vetted because of the momentum of these early races.
There are also different kinds of primaries, aren't there? Some lead to proportional representation. Others are winner-take-all. Do you think
some of them are beauty contests and not binding? Some are binding.
Do you think it might be better if they all were? There was a fair amount of consistency. I would like to see proportional everywhere, because that would give a more of a real sense of how the voters feel, rather than winner take all.
Well, I mean, there are any number of proposals that are out there, and I think that this the movements of California, Florida, Texas, and New York of making this what effectively is a national primary. I'm hoping that that's really going to force the parties and the states to take a serious look at this whole system, because it really is dysfunctional right now.
Well, until recently, we had the Super Duper Tuesday on February 5th, but you mentioned Florida.
Right.
Florida ignored the threats from both parties and voted earlier this month to move its primaries to January 29th, the same day as the South Carolina primary. And and the parties don't like it, but it means that perhaps Super Duper Tuesday is going to have little impact in the near future.
Well, it's chaotic. It makes it very difficult for the candidates to figure out what they're doing. Basically, what it means now is that any candidate who wants to be serious has to have a great deal of money and a great deal of organization already in place early, because once the horses are out of the gate with Iowa in January, there isn't going to be any time to reposition, to catch up, to raise new funds. So the old system of primaries, where an insurgent candidate could kind of come out of nowhere and make a splash and then perhaps go on to capture the nomination, and that's basically over now. Only a few candidates will be able to stay in the race over the long run. And my guess is that one of the things that will happen is right now we have, you know, 9 and 10 candidates in each of these party contests, and they will have to drop out, I think, quite quickly.
Wouldn't a state that had a late primary under these circumstances be pretty much abdicating any chance of having an impact? It seems to me what we're moving toward is everybody having a primary somewhere in January and then having a very long election cycle.
Oh, it sounds appalling, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds like, like two people at each other's throats from January. Yeah. Forget about the conventions, because it will already know who the candidates are by somewhere in early February.
Sure, and the ads will start very early, because the candidates won't want to let the other side define them with ads. So it's just going to be a very long race, and there are many political observers, and I'm one of them, that worry that the electorate will just get so turned off with this long, 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 long contest that it will be counterproductive.
On the other hand, all that extra time, won't it give us more of an opportunity to have real issues discussed and have a real sense of who the candidates are?
Well, I think what tends to happen is that the news media, because, you know, early on they cover the campaign message, what the candidates' issue positions are, and so, you know, that's old news. And so what tends to happen is that the horse race coverage, the poll-based coverage, the kind of strategic games that the candidates are playing with each other, that tends to become more important, because the candidates basically have the sort of the appeals that they've decided to run on, those don't change very much. And so you end up having the more cynical aspects of electoral politics being showcased in the news, I think.
Professor Fowler,
positions aren't changing.
What would you do to change it? Would you do something to change it? And do you think there's a possibility that everybody could be so dissatisfied that we'll go back to something else in 2012 or 2016?
There are three principles, and I don't have, you know, specific procedures, but these are the principles that I would look at. One is I would have something that was geared much later in the calendar. So the choice of nominees, you know, somewhere between June and August, rather than this very early process. I would want something that would make the process predictable for the candidates, so that they could organize their campaigns in a reasonable way. And maybe that means 4 regional primaries that are scheduled a month apart from each other. Maybe it means a lottery system for different states to be the primary participants, for different electoral cycles. Maybe it means going back to a convention system where state party caucuses meet in, you know, in the late spring and choose real delegates who then go to the convention and make real decisions again.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, although in 2012, if there's an incumbent, he will have a huge, or she will have a huge advantage if we stay with this system. Linda L. Fowler, professor of government and the Frank J. Reagan 09 chair in policy studies at Dartmouth College. Thank you so much. On tomorrow's show, the African bureau chief of Toronto's Globe and Mail makes the AIDS epidemic personal with 28 individual portraits of Africans living with HIV and AIDS. And then Khaled Hosseini follows his best-selling debut novel, The Kite Runner, with another one also set in Afghanistan, plus Aaron Burr's controversial legacy, and a look at whether environmental activism is tied to a larger social justice movement. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Fran Jacobs and Brad Ludlow. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.